case, Matamoros versus Grahams. Ms. Lennon.
Good morning. My name is Julie Lennon, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Jose Matamoros. We're not asking the court to find that committing armed robbery is reasonable. We're not asking the court to say that Mr. Matamoros...
That's a relief.
We're not asking the court to say that Mr. Matamoros should not be punished for committing armed robbery. And we're not asking this court to determine that Mr. Matamoros' term of special parole was invalid as imposed in 1983.
So here's the problem, though. We have timestamps from the Parole Commission and also received locally indicating that the error is caught and the special parole term is now recognized as of the afternoon of the fateful day. And we have the agent's testimony credited by the district court that he tried to contact Mr. Matamoros. And it's only in the evening, 9 o'clock or so, that Mr. Matamoros takes it upon himself to commit this new crime of a very brutal armed robbery. And it's the standard of review that I think is very difficult. We've got very solid evidence that the if it mattered, I'm not really sure it does matter, but if it did matter, we know that he knows before he goes out and commits this robbery that he's actually under criminal justice restriction.
Well, I have a number of responses to that, but the most important response is that it wasn't credited by the district court that Agent Sebasta actually made the call that day. It's still in dispute. The district court made no findings of facts on that. There was no evidentiary hearing held where the district court could credit Agent Sebasta over Mr. Matamoros, who still maintains that that call was never made that day. Agent Sebasta's affidavit was filed 4 years after the phone call was allegedly made. And even in the affidavit, he admits that it wasn't in his call logs that he made the call.
Right.
So there are clearly problems with Officer Sebasta's, Agent Sebasta's affidavit, and the district court didn't make a finding on that. The district court said whether or not this call was made, here's the decision.
I have to say that strikes me as fairly reasonable too, because suppose there was no special parole term and the congratulations, you're done, you know, letter was correct, the August 3rd letter. And then on September 9th, he goes out and commits this armed robbery thinking, good, you know, I'm out of the criminal justice system, so I can go beat up, you know, burn people with cigarettes again. Why is that actually even different from what happened? I mean, I know that the state authorities are aware that he committed this crime while he was under the special parole term, but I'm not sure where his liberty interest in getting all this corrected lies.
Well, the consequences of the detainer that's currently lodged against him is that he can't participate in programming at the prisons, he can't be eligible for early release, and on top of that, the real liberty interest at stake is the fact that he could be revoked on his parole mm-hmm. based on his conduct here and serve an additional 3 years, 4 years on top of the current time that he's serving in state custody right now.
So you're describing consequences, but I don't know why they're constitutionally protected consequences, why he has some constitutional interest in not facing those things.
Well,
you've conceded that the original imposition of the special parole term was appropriate.
Right. We did concede that, but for the due process argument, there needs to be a liberty interest at stake, a constitutional liberty interest at stake. For the equitable estoppel argument, though, there doesn't need to be a constitutional right necessarily at stake. The liberty interest, though, is that he faces future confinement based on the detainer, the warrant that have been lodged against him, and the revocation that will follow after he's released.
Yeah. I'm not sure why this is the time to consider that, and given Moody against Daggett and so on, I'm not really sure how far you'd get with the need for an immediate dispositional review. Equitable estoppel is very hard since, you know, it's hard to see how Agent Savasta's error, that of the parole commission, triggered any reasonable reliance. He can't say he relied and felt that he was free to go commit burglaries or
Right. I don't mean to interrupt, Your Honor.
No, go ahead.
But that's not what we're not saying that committing burglary or robbery is reasonable. We're not saying that the action he took in reliance was reasonable. We're saying that reasonable reliance in and of itself, under the language in Heckler, requires that it was reasonable for Mr. Matamoros to think that he was no longer subject to the parole commission's
jurisdiction. But what does his thought have to do with anything if he, in fact, uses this liberty that he thinks he has in such a bad way?
Well, we can use a reasonable person standard then. Whether or not under the circumstances, especially considering the complexity of the case, the amount of time that he's been on parole and incarcerated based on this offense, whether it was reasonable for somebody in his position to interpret Agent Savasta's affirmative actions. It's not just that he forgot to issue the certificate of special parole. It's that he issued the notice of discharge, the exit survey, the letter of congratulations. Whether taking those things and the complexity of the case as a whole, whether or not it's reasonable for somebody in his position to feel as though they're no longer subject to the jurisdiction of the parole commission and cannot face revocation based on their conduct.
Now, do you seriously think that Mr. Matamoros would have refrained from this action if he had realized that he was also risking revocation of special parole?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. And I think if, going back to your first question, if there was an evidentiary hearing, if there had been an evidentiary hearing to look at whether that phone call was actually made or what Mr. Matamoros was thinking that day, I might be able to give you a better answer to that. I do think it's interesting, though, that because you brought up this question, that in the police reports attached to the government's brief, one of Mr. Matamoros's people he went and did this robbery with actually said that Mr. Matamoros was off paper. So they knew that before they committed the armed robbery, and that to an extent might have factored into their decision, but I can't say for sure because we don't know. So I'd like to transition back to the remedy we're seeking, which is to have the detainer lifted and an order that Mr. Matamoros can't face revocation when he's released from state custody. We're not saying that he should be discharged from his 3-year term of special parole. What we're saying, though, is that we're asking this court to find that the parole commission's affirmative actions, the notice of discharge, the exit survey, and the letter given to Mr. Matamoros on August 3rd, had the effect of staying commencement of his term of special parole until October 10th of 2006, the time he first received notice that he was still subject to the parole commission's jurisdiction. So when you were referencing, Judge Wood, earlier, the certificate of special parole that was issued, it was issued, and we don't dispute that. His term of special parole should have, according to the statute, started running on August 3rd. The problem, though, is that he didn't receive notice of that. He wasn't given information indicating that he was still subject to the jurisdiction of the commission. He didn't get the certificate of special parole. He didn't sign it.
You say he didn't get it till October 10th?
Correct, Your Honor. That's the first time it's documented in the record that he was read or told that he was subject to the parole commission's jurisdiction. And if there are no further questions at this point, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Lennon. Mr. Koenig?
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Jonathan Koenig. I appear on behalf of the respondent this morning. And I'd like to begin by trying to respond to some of Judge Wood's questions and some of my opponent's comments towards the end of her argument about the certificate of special parole. It's not clear to me that the certificate itself has any special magic to it, other than to remind people that a special term of parole is commencing or has commenced. That's different from a regular parole certificate, which the prison has to have before it can release you into the general population. So I guess I'd begin with that point and also add that, of course, Mr. Matamoros was on notice of the special parole term in 1983 as part of the judgment and the proceedings. The law on the books at that time was on notice.
Of course, we're holding him to a rather higher degree of memory retention than either the Parole Commission or Agent Savasta, you know, because, I mean, I'm sure no one seems to have put the transcript of that 1982 sentencing into the record, so I have no idea what the judge in Louisiana said or didn't say about the special parole. But it does seem to have slipped everybody's mind. But your argument is that it just starts up as a matter of law, no matter whether somebody's told or not?
Yes, Your Honor, that's my understanding. And that's supported by the wording of the regulation in the CFR. I believe it's 28 CFR 2.57D, which is talked about in that Chilcote case, if you care to consult it. We are perhaps holding Mr. Matamoros to a high standard of memory, but while we're talking about equity, I think it's fair to point out that the reason we're here in 2012 is partly because of the way special parole works, but it's also because of Mr. Matamoros' own conduct. That's why this has drawn itself out over such a very long period.
Does the government concede that equitable estoppel runs against the government?
No, we certainly aren't. And Your Honor, there may come a day when this court chooses to recognize that equitable estoppel can be used against the government. I would submit that this is not the proper vehicle to do that. And I would also point out, should we
address it at all?
I think there's a threshold question of whether the court can address a free-floating equitable estoppel claim independent of a constitutional violation. I think it's pretty clear when you look at Moody versus Daggett, there's no problem.
My question, I suppose, is more pointed that is there a possibility that you can conceive in which equitable estoppel runs against the government in a criminal context?
Well, the closest I can imagine would be the Ninth Circuit case cited by my opponent, but I want to point out that the facts of that case are very, very different from what we have here. In the Johnson versus Willicott case, the prisoner was released on parole. He had been out in the community for more than a year, been reunited with his family. He'd even started a small business. And then the government said, oops, that offense was you weren't eligible for parole. We're going to take you back and put you in prison.
A different point.
That might
be everything altogether. That is, and I wouldn't even call that equitable estoppel. But
we're so far from these facts, Your Honor. And as Judge Wood pointed out in her question, the defendant's own conduct in a matter of hours after hearing from Agent Savasta, it doesn't leave him with clean hands to come in asking for equity. I'm happy to answer any other questions you may have. Obviously, we think you should affirm Judge Goldberg.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Koenig. Ms. Lennon?
I think I'd like to first address the clean hands doctrine, which the government just spoke about. The clean hands doctrine has not been raised before as a sort of affirmative defense by the government in this case, which is the number one problem. But in Gutierrez versus Gonzalez, this court addressed sort of the clean hands doctrine in the equitable estoppel context and said, in a case where it hasn't been raised before, it might be evaluated under the affirmative misconduct prong of equitable estoppel. And so just to briefly address the affirmative misconduct prong, Mr. Matamoros had no he didn't.
Well, I take it he did not rely on anything when he decided to commit the crime, the last crime he committed.
Well, Your Honor,
he's not relying on the fact that he thought he was off parole.
I think he was relying on the fact that he
so
would
therefore
face...
he can commit another crime without any serious consequences.
No, not exactly. We're not saying that he expected not to face any consequences. He expected to face state consequences. He expected that he'd be punished for that, but he didn't expect that he'd be punished on top of that by the parole commission and possibly revoked and spent additional time in federal prison. So his reliance was that he wouldn't face parole commission consequences, not that he wouldn't be punished. What was that?
I said, I bet you he didn't think about it at all.
I think that's up for dispute, and we don't know that. And if this case sort of falls on whether or not he thought about it at all or whether or not the phone call was actually made by Agent Sebastian,
I agree with that.
This case needs to be remanded for an evidentiary hearing to better address that. And just to address Judge Wood's question to the government, I do think agents need to be held to the same standards as their parolees and expected to abide by rules and procedures just like the parolees are.
Are you suggesting that there's affirmative misconduct here, Ms. Lennon, as opposed to negligence? When you read the affidavit, it does sound like it was a mistake here.
It's not. It's our position that it wasn't just a mistake. A mistake not amounting to affirmative misconduct might have been just not issuing the certificate of special parole. What pulls it into the affirmative misconduct prong is that he was sent a notice of discharge, he was given a congratulatory letter, an exit survey, all of which were affirmative positive actions that created
that
the...
That all flowed, though, from arguably a mistake, right? I understand those are all affirmative actions that are sequential, but...
Right, and I don't think it was just a mistake. He had the. We're not saying that he intentionally did it, he acted with any sort of malevolence, or tried to trick Mr. Matamoros in any way. It doesn't require intent, though. It requires more than mere negligence. The definition isn't clear. This court has said that it's an affirmative action to mislead or affirmatively misguiding. That doesn't require intent. So Agent Sevasta presumably had the information in a file sitting in front of him when he issued the notice of discharge. Otherwise, he wouldn't have discovered it a month later. So even though he had that information in front of him, he issued the notice of discharge anyways. He said, congratulations, Mr. Matamoros, you're done. We won't see you again. And that amounts to affirmative misconduct.
You're trying to trick him, do you?
I don't, but I don't think that's required for affirmative misconduct. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Lennon. Thanks to all counsel, Ms. Koenig. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.